You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. My name is Michelle Dunn. I'm from the Middle East program here at Carnegie. And welcome to this event on Egypt's transition and security reform. I want to start by thanking the Project on Middle East Democracy, our partner in this event, and the Open Society Foundation for their support of a series of events with guests from Egypt that POMED and Carnegie have been doing together. This topic, security reform, is a little bit under the radar or off the screen as we watch the Egyptian transition, but it is so critical, I think. Political issues are perhaps getting more, elections and constitutional reform and so forth are getting more attention. But in my opinion, reform of the internal security services here, and today we're going to be speaking primarily about that, about internal security services as opposed to the armed forces, which of course the armed forces and the Supreme Council, the armed forces are actually in political control of the country now. But the internal security has played such a role and such a deleterious role in political life in the country and in the human rights situation in Egypt for a long time, that I've long been of the opinion that if there are not serious changes in internal security in Egypt, then nothing is going to change, no matter what kind of electoral provisions you put into place and how many political parties are, that this is an essential element if Egypt is going to transition to democracy. There have been a lot of security problems in Egypt recently. We've been hearing about sectarian problems between Muslims and Christians, and also a general sense that crime is rising. And there is a growing sense of concern in Egypt and of public dissatisfaction and questions about where are these security threats coming from. And I think you'll hear today in our discussion some different explanations of what is going on. Is it simply the post-revolutionary confusion? Or are there forces at work who actually are deliberately creating security problems for political reasons? That will be something we will discuss. There have been some announced security reform efforts. The Egyptian authorities announced a couple of months ago that the infamous state security, basically the secret police, were disbanded and something new called national security would be created in its place that would have a more limited role. But there's a real question as to whether that's really happening, what's going on, what is the real, is there a real process of change underway or not? Understanding that these things take time, but there, at least it's been announced that they are beginning now. We'll be discussing whether that's really the case or not. There are many things that are hanging fire. The military council has promised lifting the state of emergency that Egypt has been under since 1981 and restoring something more like the rule of law. They've promised to do that before parliamentary elections in September, but that has not happened yet. And there's a broader question, I think, as Egypt moves forward about whether there will be civilian control of the internal security sector as well as of the armed forces. There has not been in the past. We have, I think, with us wonderful guests to discuss this today, people who have been seized with this matter for a long time. To my left is Dr. Mohamed Qadri Saeed, who has joined us from Egypt for this event and for this week. He's the head of the Military Studies Unit at the Al Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Cairo. He serves as the center's coordinator on a project of regional security in the Middle East and North Africa, and he's a member of the Egyptian Council on Foreign Affairs, and he has written on security reform, and I would note he has written on security reform in Egypt at a time when it was not necessarily, well, before the, when it was not necessarily easy to do so. At the end of the table is Omar Afifi Suleiman. He's a former police officer in Egypt and a former Supreme Court lawyer. He's the author of an extremely popular book called So You Don't Get Hit on the Back of Your Neck, which was banned in Egypt. It was a guide to Egyptians of how to avoid getting their rights abused by police. He has been in the United States now for several years and was active in the online protest movement in helping to organize the January 25th revolution. And to my right is Robert Perito, who directs the U.S. Institute of Peace's Security Sector Governance Center. He's a former Foreign Service Minister and a former Deputy Executive Secretary of the National Security Council, and he will be helping us look at what's going on to Egypt and putting it into a more global perspective. How do we match up what's going on or what is or isn't happening in the security situation and the security reform situation in Egypt with what has happened elsewhere in other transitions? So we'll have each of the speakers speak for a few minutes, and then we will open it up to your questions. So, I'm sorry.
Shall I introduce myself?
I'm very sorry. And translating for Omar Afifi Suleiman will be Mukhtar Kamel. He is the communications director of the Alliance of Egyptian Americans. He has volunteered to help with the translation today because he knows this subject very well. But he also wanted to mention that he's going to be translating for Omar rather than giving his own personal opinions of the subject. Okay, so let's begin with Dr. Qadri, please.
I would like at the beginning to thank Mr. Stephen McInerney, Executive Director of Project on Middle East Democracy, and Professor Michelle Don of the Carnegie Endowment for inviting me to this event. It is very important to me to talk about it. It is in this distinguished presence of specialized people, and to explain how Egypt looked to security sector reform as part of its vision for future democracy in Egypt. Egypt's history was always existing, especially in the last 60 years. There was always a lot of transitions, and this transition have different phases. For example, from kingdom to republic, and from socialism to private economy, and from war to peace with Israel. And now we are coming to another transition, is how to go to full-fledged democracy in Egypt, and also how to deal with security sector reform if we believe in democracy. Democracy is a very important sector. Without it, you cannot go without having security in Egypt. In general, and I live in Al Ahram Center, I receive a lot of investors who come to Egypt planning to build a factory or something. And the question number one, he asked about the police, and he asked how the people treated in the police stations. And also he asked about the role of the military in Egypt. And from this point, I was convinced that security sector reform is the shortest way to development. If it is not taken seriously, you cannot develop your country. To be short, I think this is now said and done by the military high council in Egypt. They said that we aided the revolution, 25th January revolution, and we are aiming and targeting to build democracy in Egypt. And I will talk about how this will impact on security sector in Egypt. Well, the security sector consists of three basic things. I mean, we have the armed forces, and also the internal forces, and we have also the intelligence, which also divided by outside intelligence and also internal intelligence. These three institutions, we should focus on them if we really will live in a democratic society. There's a number of points which should be addressed if we go in this track. Recently, I published an article in Ahram newspaper. I call it Al-Gish Fi Zaman Al-Demokratiya, or the military in time of democracy, how they should behave. And we have a list which I am suggested to be discussed with the military. Number one, what will be their relation with the parliament? We haven't a parliament now, but we will go into election. We'll have a parliament, would be elected in a very, correct way. And the armed forces as an institution, how will deal with this kind of parliament? I think the parliament will have the right to oversight the military, not only in money, but also in performance. Egypt, I think, also suffered a lot in 1967 because the performance of the military was not to the right edge. But now I think the people in democratic society will have the right to make some accountability on the military. Number two, we have this emergency law, which is really used badly by both the internal security apparatus and also sometimes also by the military. And this emergency law, there is some promise by the military that this law will be, removed, canceled before the coming election for choosing, new parliament and new president. This law practically is very bad. It gives authorities to the state to arrest anybody for any reason. We have also the relation between the military and the media, and in many levels, secrecy was always there. One word is sometimes is considered as a secret of state, and sometimes even people are arrested for saying something which is very trivial, is not important. This relation with the media and what is said in the media about the military is very important, and I think also this was one of the aspects which should be taken into consideration for the future. We have also a lot of talk about the military economy. I mean that the military has its own economy, its own industries, its own money. And this is one of the questions which is always repeated when the people come to my office asking if really the military has its own economy. And I try to explain to them that this is not exactly as you said, but it is a topic in a way which should be discussed by in the media, by the people. And I think it is one of the aspects which I am sure personally that there is no military economy, but as it is said in public, we should have the right also to put the people in perspective and to explain to them the real situation. We have also this perception of the people about the armed forces, how they see the armed forces. And this is reflected by many means. Part of it is coming in the culture itself. And it was at certain time, maybe some of the Egyptian here in know that there was a series of films that about the Egyptian army. It takes some sort of comics, but in the same time it was Ismail Yassin. This was very famous actor, and he there is a film about the Navy, another film about the Air Force, and of course this is all stopped from long time, and I think the society should also have its own perception about what is going on inside the military. Also, the accountability and the oversight of the parliament. This is also a very important point, which I think we'll start to exercise it with the new parliament. The last thing is that the military and governance, and there was some tradition that number one, that the military should be represented inside the cabinet by a number of ministers, and also the governors of the governance also. Share of it is given to the military, and another share for the judge, and so on. There is we faced a problem recently in Kenya, for example, that the people, one of the governor in Egypt, in Upper Egypt, here the people refused the governor nominated by the state higher council, and there was a big problem. And recently, maybe this week, there is some news in the newspaper. They said that governors in the future will be elected directly by the people, and this is it seems also approved by the military council. All these points, I think, are important. Plus also this issue of performance. I mean, Egypt is not only defending its country, it has a regional commitments, and performance, which is coming from training, from education, from a lot of things, I think it is important to be taken into consideration for the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Khadri. I thought that was interesting, in particular, that you're expecting parliamentary oversight of the military. Maybe we can talk about later if that would include oversight of the military budget and transparency of the military budget, which would involve these military industries and so forth. But now we'll move to Omar Afifi Suleiman. Thank you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. في كتير معتقدين ان الثورة المصرية انتهت ولذلك احنا بنبتدي في عملية البناء لكن في الحقيقة ان الثورة المصرية لا زالت مستمرة طالما لم تحقق اهدافها كاملة ولا يزال النظام
There are a lot of people who think that the Egyptian revolution has not been completed yet, which is normal. And this revolution should continue and will continue as long as its objectives have not been realized yet, because whoever is governing today is an extension of the Mubarak regime. And those individuals were chosen by him.
وهم امتداد طبيعي المجموعة الحاكمة دلوقتي بما يسمى المجلس العسكري هي امتداد طبيعي لحكومة مبارك احنا هنتكلم على الموضوع الحالي دلوقتي هو عملية الانفلات الامني اللي هو بيهددوا به الناس بيخوفوا به الناس الانفلات الامني وحنجوع بعد شوي
Right now, I'm going to talk about the lax security situation in the country, and it seems that there are some entities or some sources that are threatening people with such insecure situation in the society in general.
هل في انفلات أمني حالي؟ وهل هذا الانفلات مصطنع ولا ده نتيجة للثورة؟ ده سؤال مهم.
Is it really security laxity? Is it really manufactured, or this is natural, or a combination of both? And this is what I'm going to touch on briefly.
الانفلات الأمني الحالي هو انفلات سياسي, انفلات أمني سياسي مصطنع. طب مين اللي بيصطنعه؟ المجلس العسكري وبقايا النظام السابق.
Now, I do believe that it is overwhelmingly manufactured, and the manufacturer here is the Supreme Council, the military Supreme Council.
هما بيخيروا الناس بين حاجتين, يسرقك يحرقك.
They are giving people a choice, either to rob you or to kill you or to injure you.
المشكلة الأمنية عندنا تتلخص في حاجتين, البلطجة, نظرية البلطجة أو ما يسمى بالبلطجة. الحاجة الثانية اللي هي الفتنة الطائفية.
There are two manifestations of the security laxity in the Egyptian society. One of them is hooliganism and the other one is a sectarian conflict that we have seen recently escalating.
طيب, الدليل اللي أنا بتهم المجلس العسكري وبقايا النظام, إيه دليلي؟ لازم أقدم الدليل على كده. لو نفتكر في ثورة 25 يناير, كان المسلم والمسيحي في الميدان, لم يتعرض مسيحي واحد إلى أي أذى.
What is my proof of what I'm trying to say, accusing the Supreme Military Council of manufacturing this? The proof, or one of the important proofs, is the revolution itself, which started in January 25th, as there was no any sign, there was not any sign of sectarian conflict in the Liberation Square. Both Muslims and Christians coexisted very harmonically.
طب البلطجة ما كانش فيه أمن. إشمعنى البلطجة ظهرت دلوقتي وما كانش فيه بلطجة وقت بداية الثورة من يوم 25 يناير؟ لأن الثوار بنفسهم هم الذين حموا مصر أثناء الثورة. لكن دلوقتي في ظاهرة البلطجة. ليه دلوقتي هقول.
Why didn't we witness hooliganism during the revolution? In fact, the people have protected each other and have protected the vicinities when there were demonstrations, and the environment was really conducive to that. However, it didn't happen. And right now I'm going to explain to you why it didn't happen at that time.
لأنهم عايزين من الآخر ما يتخلوش عن السلطة اللي موجودة في إيديهم دلوقتي, أو يجيبوا البديل لمبارك بس يلبسوه بدلة جديدة. لكن هم عايزين يحافظوا على الإيكونومي اللي سيادة اللواء قال عليه, إن الجيش بيتحكم في أكتر من 30% من اقتصاد مصر عن طريق الشركات اللي بتشتغل, وتحول العسكري المصري من مقاتل على الجبهة إلى راجل بيزرع وبيعمل حلاوة طحينية.
Basically, there was no incentive during the revolution for hooliganism. However, there is an incentive for the military ruling class right now to either to spread that or to turn the to look at the other side while it is going on. Basically, the army controls about 30% of the Egyptian economy, as the general hinted to before. And based on that, they would like to maintain their vested interest in controlling the society. Now, the Egyptian soldier has been transformed from a fighter into a peasant or a laborer or something like that, that is not consistent with the professional with a professional fighting force.
احنا جايين نتكلم عن إعادة أجهزة الأمن وأجهزة الشرطة مرة تانية وتقويتها. لازم نفرق بين الأمن السياسي والأمن المركزي والأمن الجنائي. احنا محتاجين نعيد الأمن الجنائي حاليا وبأقصى سرعة.
Now that we are talking about the restructuring and reform of the security apparatus, I would like to distinguish in between three elements of security. Basically, the security apparatus here, meaning the police. There is the political security, and there is the central security, that's in Egypt, of course, and there is the criminal security.
لو احنا فكرنا ان احنا عايزين نرجع الامن المركزي دلوقتي بطريقته اللي كانت وبالنظام اللي فات، يبقى احنا عايزين نسيطر على الثورة التي لم تكتمل بعد بالقوة البوليسية وتساندها القوة العسكرية.
If we now that the central security has been, I mean, the people in Egypt has been told that the central security has been abolished. However, if we think of it returning back, the obvious meaning of that would be this is for the purpose of controlling the society and controlling the momentum of the revolution through police force supported by the military.
ضباط الشرطة في مصر، وأنا واحد منهم، واحد يعني زميل ليهم وعلى علاقة كاملة بيهم، خدنا قرار لن ندافع عن فساد سياسي مرة أخرى. اللي بياخد قرار سياسي خاطئ يستفز مشاعر الناس يتحمل مسؤولية قراره. اللي يشيل قربة مخرومة تخر على دماغه لوحده. يعني لما الحكومة تاخد قرار ان هي تجيب محافظ على غير إرادة الشعب، مش هنقف نواجه إرادة الشعب مرة تانية. احنا مع الشعب وحنظل مع الشعب، مش ضد إرادة الشعب.
I would like to tell you that the police officers in Egypt have taken a particular decision, which is never to stand against the people and in order to protect political corruption. I have taken this position as an ex-police officer, and some of my colleagues in service have taken this position also. Now, he's referring to an Egyptian proverb saying that if anybody carries a jar of water and the jar of water has a hole in it, so the water will spill over your own hair, meaning that whenever you take a wrong decision or you do something wrong, you bear the responsibility for it and you will be ultimately held accountable for it.
حدي مثال صغير. امبارح حصل الافراج عن ثلاثه في منتهى الخطوره، فتح سرور، زكريا عزمي، سوزان مبارك.
Yesterday three corrupt people were released. Now فتح سرور who was the chief of the parliament, زكريا عزمي who was number one in the bureau of the president, President Mubarak, and his wife Suzanne Mubarak, the three of them were released yesterday.
المطلوب ان الشرطه تطلع تضرب الناس في الشارع نتيجة القرار الخاطئ.
Are we going to have the police go out when people demonstrate against such a strange decision to release these guys? Are going to be, is the police going to hit the people and use force against them in order to stop demonstrations?
في مليون واحنا قاعدين دلوقتي في ميدان التحرير، مش مفروض ان احنا نضربهم، المفروض احنا كشرطة نحميهم، لكن هو لازال بيمارسوا نفس الممارسات الخاطئة السابقة.
Right now, as we speak, there are a million people demonstrating in the Liberation Square in Cairo, and against, I mean, protesting against this particular decision. And the police should not really try to liquidate or try to disperse them. The police should rather try to protect them.
طب إزاي نعيد الأمن الجنائي؟ الأمن الجنائي اللي هو قتل وسرق. الشرطة مهمتها الأولى هي حماية أمن المواطن في الشارع والبيت ضد الجريمة. إزاي؟ أنا هقول بس نقاط أساسية كمقترح. يعني أولاً لابد من توجيه جهود الشرطة بالكامل للعمل في الأمن الجنائي وليس في العمل في الأمن السياسي، لأن على مدار 30 سنة الشرطة مهمتها الأساسية حفاظ على كرسي السلطة، على حفاظ على كرسي مبارك. ده لابد من تعديل هذا المفهوم تماما. والدليل على ذلك أنه غير اسم كلية الشرطة إلى أكاديمية مبارك للأمن.
Basically the police function should be only focused on the criminal part of it. The police should protect the people against crimes, whatever it is. rather than focusing most of the energies of the police in order to protect a particular political regime, especially if it is corrupt. Now, for 30 years, the police have been used as an apparatus in order to protect the chairs of power and authority in the country. And one proof of that, even symbolic, that under Mubarak regime, they have changed the name of the police academy to the Mubarak Academy.
الشرطة عندنا بتشتغل كل حاجة من أول الدفاع المدني للجوازات للأحوال المدنية لابد من تخليص الشرطة من هذه الأعباء اللي مش بتاعتها علشان تتفرغ للأمن الجنائي اللي هو أمن المواطن.
Also, the police used to be used for other functions that are not really into the core function of the police, such as immigration, issuing visas, supervising certain personal laws, and so on and so forth. And that should be cancelled, of course. I mean, police officers who are graduated from the police academy should not be wasted in such work.
كل القيادات الداخلية دلوقتي اشتغلت مع حبيب العدلي لفترة 14 سنة وهم تلامذته فكيف يكون هم الآن قادة وزارة الداخلية لم يتم التخلص من أي فاسد أقل واحد فيهم كان بياخد مليون جنيه في الشهر من هذه القيادات وبالتالي فكلهم لابد من إما إحالتهم للمعاش إما يروحوا الوظائف مدنية مع تأهيلهم لأن دول ناس بالعربي زي ما بيقولوا مصاصين دماء فالإصلاح فيهم أو بقائهم هو إضرار بجهاز الأمن.
Now the high commands of the Interior Ministry, which is the ministry supervising the police, those generals and brigadier generals have been at least in service for 14 years. Under the ex-interior minister, which is Habib Al-Adli, an ex-police officer also. And the least fortunate among them, his salary would be about £1 million a month. That's the equivalent of about $200,000 a month. And certainly those people have vested interest in the old regime. And therefore, if you want to reform, you have to remove these people from the higher echelons of the decision-making in the police. They should be retired, or they should be transferred to civil jobs, whatever it is, and you can give them packages, you can give them some training, you can basically qualify them in order to start new life in the new civil society in Egypt. Those people, I would like to call them vampires, as simple as that.
لابد من تعيين الخريجين من كليات الحقوق وكليات الشريعة والقانون لضخ دم جديد في وزارة الداخلية وناس دارسة للقانون ومؤمنة بحقوق الإنسان بالفعل لمساعدة الضباط الحاليين بعد ما تتخلص من جزء من الفاسدين منهم.
Now that you are going to have some sort of cleansing within the ranks of the police, you can use newly graduates from the schools of law in the country, the schools of religious jurisprudence, and give them short training in order to play supportive roles in helping the core police force. Those people, because they are young, they are the sons of the revolution, and because they are newly graduated, they are much more familiar with human rights and with how to respect the law and so on. And those people can be of great assistance to the core of the police officers who are not going to be in the cleansing process.
محتاجين 3 شهور تدريب بس. الشرطة يعني ما فيهاش أشياء معقدة ولا حاجة. مدام معاه لسانس حقوق. هيتدرب من شهر لثلاثة يبقى ضابط شرطة موجود في الشارع ويكلف بالأعمال البسيطة زي الحراسات والأشياء البسيطة في الشرطة الحاجة اللي بعد كده تحسين أحوال ضباط الشرطة المالية ضابط الشرطة بياخد مليون جنيه في الشهر واحد بياخد 700 جنيه في الشهر وهو ده اللي شايل أمن البلد على كتفه إزاي؟ إزاي يبقى الضابط مش لاقي ياكل؟
Those guys, the newly graduated people, they, I suggest that the training would, for them would take from 1 to 3 months, because it, it is not really rocket science, since they are carriers of a bachelor's degree in law or whatever it is. They would be able to absorb the training very easily during this relatively short period of time. They will perform relatively simple functions, such as guarding banks, schools, or whatever it is, and we have to qualify that also. Concerning the police officers, we have to improve their salaries so that they wouldn't have incentive to be bribed. And I give you an example. The higher-ranking police officers, one of them, as I said before, would have his salary at 1 million Egyptian pounds a month, while the lower rank would have 700. And, of course, the difference is clear.
لأن الوقت خلص هقول ثلاث نقط بسرعة ويبقى عندنا فرصة في الأسئلة. إفاد بعثات للتدريب العملي لضباط الشرطة في الدول اللي بتحترم القانون ويمارس عمليا في المكان. الحاجة الثانية الرقابة القضائية الصارمة على البحث الجنائي وعلى الأمن الوطني اللي بيسم أو الأمن الدولة اللي بيسموه الأمن الوطني. تكوين مجموعات من للرقابة الشعبية على مستوى كل قسم أو كل دائرة. وأعتقد يعني طبعاً الوقت مش هيسمح بكل الأشياء.
Alright, since time has, I mean, there is shortage of time right now, I just will conclude by saying that I have three recommendations for training the police officers and changing their behavior. Number one is to send them for training in democratic countries, preferably in the West, and the training should be practical training, meaning that the police officer, the Egyptian one, would stand aside with the American counterpart and go to the street with him and watch how the American policeman works. Number two is judicial monitoring and surveillance. It should be firm. And number three is to form popular committees among people in order to participate in the monitoring of the police work. And thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so I want to just clarify something. In terms of the internal security forces of Egypt, what we're looking at is basically three branches, right? There was the regular police, that were the largest group, the central security that are basically sort of the riot police, and the state security, which were the secret police. And what's been announced so far is supposedly reform of the state security, or changing the mission of the state security to be going after terrorism and so forth, and not getting involved in the politics of the country. Before, if you'll be patient with us for one more minute, Bob, before we move to your comment, I would like both Qadri and Omar to answer just in one or two sentences. To what extent, what do we know about this reform of either of any of these three branches? Is there anything really happening now, or is this something that just has been announced but is not actually underway?
I think those institutions, the problem with them, especially the security part of it, is that they go out of limits of their job. I mean, they go out of it. And for example, the intelligence part, they should use it only for defending the country and the people. But sometimes they use it for outside jobs, which can touch the individuals who are against the government, or sometimes even they touch people who did nothing, but they do it as a revenge or something like that. So these institutions, is the problem with them that there was no any oversight over them. There is no any accountability, which was missing. And I think any reform which will be applied on this institution will go into this framework. And institutions who are responsible in front of the parliament, in front of the people, they are working in their own job, not outside their job.
كل أجهزة الأمن بما فيها الجيش بما فيها الشرطة على مدار 30 سنة بتشتغل لصالح شخص واحد اسمه مبارك. لابد من تغيير المفهوم ده تماما، انه يبتدوا يشتغلوا لصالح شعب اسمه شعب مصر. ما يتم حاليا مفيش اي جهود لإعادة أجهزة الأمن حقيقية، لأن هذا الانفلات مطلوب دلوقتي علشان ما يبقاش فيه انتخابات في سبتمبر. وهقول لكم إذا كان حيجي سؤال في الموضوع ده ليه.
All the army and the police forces have been working in the last 30 years only for Mr. Mubarak, not for Egypt. And right now, obviously, this should change, that those guys should work for Egypt. And right now, there is no effort whatsoever in order to effect the reform that we heard about. And in addition to that, I repeat that the security laxity that we have hinted to before is deliberate.
Okay, thank you. So we hear about abolishment of state security. We hear maybe about another change in the interior minister and so forth. But you feel that there are no real reform efforts underway at this point. Okay. Robert Perito.
Thank you very much. I'm Bob Perito. I'm from the United States Institute of Peace. I'd like to thank Carnegie and Michelle for the opportunity to be with you this afternoon. And I'd like to also thank Mohammed and Omar for two very interesting and really very detailed presentations. And I think they provide an excellent background for the job which I've been assigned, which is to talk about the theory and practice of security sector reform as it may apply in Egypt. The principles of security sector reform are consistent with many of the recommendations that you've heard. I've also been asked to talk about the challenges which the U.S. and the international community would face in actually providing assistance to Egypt in this effort. It's very clear that the process of establishing democracy in Egypt cannot succeed without a transformation of the institutions and forces that comprise the security sector. Successful security sector reform will require the creation of security institutions that answer to a democratically elected civilian leadership and which are subjected to parliamentary oversight with real authority, as you heard from Michelle, particularly in the area of budgets and resources. Security sector institutions must be right-sized and refocused. We've heard about the involvement of the Egyptian military in the economy. Establishing democracy requires reforming powerful militaries, predatory police forces, and ruthless intelligence services. The militaries must be refocused on external defense, the role of militaries in democratic societies. Police must enforce the rule of law. Intelligence services must perform analysis and not internal operations. And this transformation everywhere has been difficult, and it will be difficult in Egypt. But it is essential to preserve the gains that have been achieved through popular demonstrations. And we have learned over the past several years that comprehensive security sector transformation can be effective in prioritizing, sequencing, managing, and implementing democratic change. The transformation must begin with a comprehensive approach that looks at the security sector as a whole, including the judiciary, those elements of the judiciary that are concerned with enforcement. A comprehensive overview ensures that all elements of the security services, not just the army, not just the police, but also powerful groups, armed groups, elements that are outside the formal structure are also included. The goal of this effort is to establish democratic governance of the security sector through a transformation of institutions that provide policy, management, administration, and logistics support, and to do that first. It is not simply to introduce or produce more effective operational security forces. And this has been our knee-jerk reaction in the past. If you look at what we've done in the Balkans, what we've done in Iraq and Afghanistan, it has been to move quickly past or even ignore those institutions of government that are responsible for overseeing the security services and to move immediately into train and equip programs designed to put operational forces into the street. The reason for this and the challenge for the United States government evolves out of a circumstance where we fail to have within our own government the kind of infrastructure we need to carry out comprehensive security sector reform programs. The United States has no counterpart to the Ministry of Interior in Iraq in any shape or form. Our Department of Interior, as you know, runs our national park system. The United States has no national police force. We have nothing like the Royal Canadian Mounties or the German police or the French national police. We certainly have no counterpart institution to the Egyptian police. And we have, most importantly of all, no central institution within the U.S. government that is responsible for implementation of security sector reform. So in the past, what's happened? As I said, the U.S. has quickly defaulted to train and equip programs. And in the Middle East in particular, these train and equip programs have been conducted in the context of a counterinsurgency agenda. Now, given our spotty track record, then, in implementing these kinds of programs, where do we look for guidance and where do we look for an overview in terms of comprehensive security reform that might be used in the Middle East? We have in the guidelines for security sector reform and in about a decade of practice some principles that have emerged, which I'd like to run through now very briefly, but because I think they're useful in terms of providing a framework in which, you know, our discussion can go forward. And you'll hear in what I'm about to say reflections of what we've heard from our first two presentations. The first principle is support host nation ownership. Accounting for the security concerns of the Egyptian people, which are broader than just physical security, is the most important factor here. It is very important for us to move past elites, to move past previous regime elements, to move to a place where we actually engage with local people who will provide guidance and then ensure proper implementation. So host nation ownership is a key principle. Another key principle is the incorporation of the principles of good government and respect for human rights. Accountability, transparency, and legitimacy must be among the primary considerations for the security sector reform process. Security services must be encouraged to meet these standards, even though it may appear in the beginning or initially to reduce their ability to restore public order and control of crime. And what we've heard in the first two presentations is a sort of repetition of a classic argument that emerges at this point in all security reform situations, in which people step forward and say, wait a minute, if we deprive the security services of their right to be arbitrary, their right to use violence, then the criminals will take over. That, in fact, turns out not to be true. In fact, it's only through the adoption by the security forces of practices of respect for human rights that they can join forces with the population, and the population joins them. Police forces have proven around the world that police forces cannot solve crime, police forces cannot provide security by themselves. They can only do that, and they do that in the United States in partnership with the community. What happens in situations like Egypt, what happened in South Africa, and what happened in other authoritarian countries is when the police are deprived for the first time of their ability to use violence and their ability to act with impunity is that they are lost. They can't fall back on the kind of moral authority and on the kind of effective policing skills that police forces enjoy in democratic societies. The reason that many of us don't break the law is not because there's no police officer around. It's because of the authority that is involved in just simply respect for the rule of law. And unless that is restored in the society, then it doesn't function. There must be balance between operational support and institutional reform. As I said, our knee-jerk reaction has always been to rush into the field to start training police. And I've been watching my colleagues at the State Department and the Justice Department. And, you know, for the first time, I'm really encouraged because I've been meeting with people at INL at State, and they said, you know, we just sent out an instructional cable the other day to our embassies, and we've asked them not to come back and recommend the usual train and equip programs, but to come back with recommendations for security sector reform, a comprehensive approach in these societies. And I just met yesterday with a team that came back from Tunisia, And I said that, you know, they had spent most of their time not with the Interior Ministry, but with the Judicial Ministry, looking at justice first rather than, you know, the police. So I think this is a positive step, but it's essential that we look at institutional reform. What are the institutions that control the security services? How do we reform them, make them democratic, make them responsive, and make them efficient before we move on to simply putting people through brief training programs, handing them a weapon, handing them a badge and a uniform, and putting them out on the street? It's very critical that we link justice with security. In situations like we have had in Egypt, where the population has rebelled because of a lack of justice, it's self-defeating then to move to a situation where justice is pushed aside or is put on the back burner or something we get to later. It's very critical that we don't make the same mistake that we made in every one of these programs, starting back with Haiti in 93, which is we train the police, we do a very commendable job of that because we can do it very fast, and then we look around and we realize that all of the prisoners that the police arrested have no jails and no courts, and we have a big problem on our hands. And so it's very important that we take a comprehensive approach. It's also very important that we focus on fostering transparency. We've already heard about the problems with secrecy and the importance of creating transparency in these agencies, which in the past have operated behind the screen or with impunity. And one thing that often happens when we go into these programs is that we end up, rather than promoting this kind of transparency, which requires time and which requires patience and requires bringing institutions out and also requires creating links with civil society and involving a wider audience, we fall prey to the pressures of deadlines that we impose upon ourselves because we have to get this program done in the fiscal year or in the next 3 months or before the, you know, the money expires, or we bring our own set of normative goods and bads and standards to bear, and we try then to impose them on people who don't react well because their standards, while equally valid, are simply different. And finally, there's a basic guideline for security sector reform programs, and it's very simple. It's three words: do no harm. We have to be constantly aware of second and third order consequences to our actions, and we have to think long term. I think that one of the things that's happening, as I've heard from various people, is that Egypt, Tunisia, and other transition and transformation states are being overwhelmed by delegations. You know, it's you get 15 minutes, and then the Danes are outside, and they get 15, and then the Norwegians, and you know, so institutions within these societies are being overwhelmed. There's a kind of sequencing going on in Egypt, as I understand it. There are things that need to get done: the constitution, elections, creation of a legitimate government, before Egypt and other countries are really ready to begin this process in a very, very serious way. And people will say, wait a minute, you know, we got to get there before the bad guys do, or we got to get there and head off the worst. But in many respects, experiences have proven out over the last decade that giving countries time to establish their own legitimate leadership and their own legitimate governments then creates a better opportunity for the international community to come in behind people that can really make decisions and begin to work to make substantial change. So those are my my words of whatever wisdom or whatever. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. I think what you say raises so many interesting questions, and one that occurs to me is that we know that the Egyptian military is probably going to continue to enjoy a great deal of influence in the country even after an elected government and president is in place and they formally hand over control. So the whole process that you talk about of restoring rule of law and establishing transparency and so forth, I think it will be very interesting going ahead to see to what extent the Egyptian military is willing to go along with that for the internal security services, knowing that, of course, the logic is that in a certain time that will be that same lens will be turned on them, transparency for their budget and all that sort of thing.
Yes, this is really critical. We can look at various examples in South Asia, Pakistan. I was just in Bangladesh a couple of months ago, where the army is the state, And unless this transition is managed, and unless this transition occurs, you're left with a country where the army is a state within a state, continues to manage its own budgets, its own resources, and continues to go its own way, kind of regardless of civilian government. So this may be the most difficult question, given the strength of these institutions. But it's essential. And you really don't get to a reformed army, however, without reforming the police and the other security services. You know, it all has to happen as a package.
Okay, thank you. All right, we'll open it up now to your questions. There are some microphones, so if you'd like to ask a question, put your hand up. Wait for a microphone to come to you. Right here, Manar. And if you would, please introduce yourself and your affiliation, and then let me know if there's a specific speaker you'd like to answer your question.
Hi, Betsy Popkin from the Public International Law and Policy Group. This is addressed to all of the speakers generally. As you know, in March, protesters stormed the state security building, some of whom found in-depth intelligence files on themselves. Have you noticed any change in civilian surveillance since abolishment of the old state security apparatus? And what needs to be done to ensure that the privacy of Egyptian citizens is not violated by the national security apparatus in the future?
Okay. I think we're going to collect a few questions at a time and then turn to the panelists. It's this gentleman right here. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Aronson. I'm with the Foundation for Middle East Peace here in Washington. I was wondering if each of our Egyptian speakers could give his understanding of the nature of the dispute between the Interior Ministry and the Army Ruling Council. What is it that the Army Ruling Council specifically was unhappy with in late January and February when the Interior Ministry forces were pulled off the street? And relating to the discussion that we just had at the end, can this problem be solved without a transformation of institutional authority in Egypt? In other words, can the Supreme Army Council fix the problem that it has with the Interior Ministry without ceding oversight to an empowered civil society? Thank you.
My name is Abdul Wahab Hassan. I'm the president of the newly founded the Egyptians Center. And my question is to my question to Mr. Robert Barreto. Since one of the elements of the security challenges to us is the sectarian violence, I feel that some elements of the extreme Christians in Egypt are being emboldened by their thinking that America and the Congress is supporting them, and they have conducted blocking highways, attacking people and drivers, and even journalists, and also kidnapping converts and using firearms. What is the American policy? Because if any support comes to these extremists, it will be interpreted as America is against them, and it will be complicating the security situation in Egypt. Thank you.
Okay, let's answer these questions first, then we'll come back for some more. Khadri, would you like to begin?
Yes, I will discuss this point about the dispute between the council and the Ministry of Interior. And if I understood well, with minister. In fact, at this time, the whole security apparatus was collapsed. I mean, there was no any solution to bring them again to the street, and it was even given some instruction to the people themselves to protect themselves, and groups of people in every street and every community, they compose some some sort of community who protect the people and to prevent any problems like that. So there was no any, I mean, misunderstanding. There was the Ministry of Interior at this time, I mean, have nothing to do. I mean, the whole power went home or already divided. Their performance was coming to zero approximately. And there was no any opportunity, I mean, to bring them back at that time.
بالنسبة للنزاع بين وزارة الداخلية والمجلس العسكري، بأكد للمرة الخمسين المجلس العسكري هو اللي عايز الانفلات الأمني، ودي لأسباب. خلينا أقولها لك ببساطة
باختصار.
أربع كنايس وشرطة وجيش مصر ما تعرفش تحميهم إزاي، أمال هتحمي مصر إزاي؟ هذا الانفلات مقصود علشان يفضلوا في الحكم، وانا بقولها لك بعد شويه هيتقال مفيش انتخابات واحنا في هذه المشكله الاقتصاديه والامنيه، وبالتالي احنا عايزين رجل قوي، عايزين لواء جيش يحكم مصر، فيبقى المشير يعنان. هي كده.
I would like to assert what I have hinted to before, which is that the Supreme Military Council really wants the insecurity rather than the security in the society. As an example, there were four churches that have been attacked and some of them burnt. And one wonders how come all the Egyptian police in combination with the army were unable to protect the churches. And if they are unable to protect the churches, how can we expect them to protect the full society and the country? Basically, it is deliberate by the military because later on they will say no elections or we will delay the elections. And they would like people to feel insecure so that people would demand a strong man. And a strong man most probably is going to be a general.
المشكلة تتحل ببساطة، بس عندما يؤمن المجلس العسكري ان في ثورة، لكن هو لحد دلوقتي عايز يلف ويدور بيلف ويدور عشان يحتل على الثورة.
Now the solution of this problem is that it will be solved automatically when the Supreme Council recognizes deeply that there is really a revolution rather than trying to go around and try to not steal the revolution but try to stifle it.
What about the question about surveillance? Surveillance by state security intelligence, has that changed since the revolution?
حضرتك بتتكلمي بجد؟ ده هو اصلا الشرطه وامن الدوله هي اللي كانت بتعمل رقابه على القضاء، فحضرتك رقابه ايه؟ ده اللي بيتعين قاضي بيتعمل عليه تحريات من امن الدوله، يعني اللي بيتعين مدرس في الجامعه بتعمل عليه تحريات من امن الدوله، بتشتغل مذيع بتعمل عليه تحريات من امن الدوله. امن الدوله كان جهاز ارهاب للجميع، ده حتى طلع في الاخر ان الحبيب العدلي كان بيراقب سيادة المشير. هو ده الواقع.
But what about now, after the revolution?
After the revolution. رقابة ما فيش رقابة. لا زال جهاز أمن الدولة موجود زي ما هو. بس قلع البدلة السوداء لبس البدلة البني. هي. من أمن الدولة للأمن الوطني يا قلبي لا تحزن.
Alright, basically that he says that this is apparently not really serious if we are talking about surveillance and monitoring the security apparatus, because basically it used to be judges who were supposed to monitor the police. It was the other way around. That was the central security was the one that is monitoring the police, monitoring the judges, monitoring the professors, university professors, lawyers, and so on and so forth. And at a certain point, it has been proven that the Minister of Interior was monitoring the Minister of the Army, who is the head of the security, military right now. After the revolution, he said that so far there is no monitoring, no surveillance whatsoever. It is just the same old regime, but with a new look.
Okay, Qadri, you want to add to that?
I am not normally with this, stories, conspiracy theory. I mean, there is some some indications that the armed forces and the council was supporting the revolution from the very beginning, and continue to that till now. I cannot understand that after the military council did with this revolution will go back again to zero. I mean, he will continue in its path. He will support them until I think. I mean, all his promises, which was given to the people, was done in time. With respect to religious sectarian violence, this is number one existing in Egypt from many years ago, even before any revolution. I mean, it happens from time to time that Copts and Muslims, they have some, confrontations. And what is happening now is it's a continuation of the past because of some, bad also arrangement socially. And in the same time, also the whole environment is a little bit volatile. At the end, I think we have the military will continue in its path, and it will support the revolution, and it will will at the end we'll see also we have an elected parliament and elected president, and Egypt will go in this direction for to be a community of democratic governance.
Please, I want to ask سيادة اللواء. هو بيقول إن الجيش أيد الثورة على الإطلاق. الجيش خضع لإرادة الشعب. كل ما يقال إن الجيش أيد الثورة ده مش حقيقي. في يوم 28 ويوم موقعة الجمل الجيش سمح بفتح ثغرات عشان الناس دي تخش وبالترتيب مع الجيش. الجيش أيد نفسه بدليل إنه هو اللي في السلطة. خلينا أقول لكم مشير طنطاوي قعد 20 سنة وزير للدفاع في هذه الوزارة الفاسدة وكان مشير لمبارك. فكيف يكون مؤمن بالثورة؟ إزاي؟ المجلس العسكري كله اللي مختاره مبارك واحد واحد. ازاي يكونوا مؤمنين بالثورة؟ نضحك على بعض. يقولك احنا كنا نقدر نفرم الناس في ميدان التحرير. ده مش حقيقي. وما يقدروش يفرموا الناس في ميدان التحرير. لان كان في بره في الشارع 18 مليون مصري. وما فيش جيش في الدنيا يقدر يضرب 18 مليون مصري. ده خضع لقوة الشعب. وحيخضع للنهاية لقوة الشعب المصري.
I have to object to the idea that the army really have supported the revolution. I hold this as completely untrue. In fact, what happened was that the army has succumbed to the will of the people. On January 28th, what has become known as the camel battle, in which everybody saw it in the TV, where camels and horses attacked people from the suburbs of Cairo. And at that time, the army have opened gaps in the ranks of the demonstrators so that the camels and horses can pass and can disperse the people demonstrating. And that's a proof that the army was not really supportive of the revolution. In fact, the army has supported itself. Tantawi, who is the head of the Supreme Council, has stayed for 20 years as Minister of War under Mubarak regime. He was handpicked by Mubarak, and all the staff under him have been handpicked by Mubarak also, and therefore it is very difficult to think that those people overnight have changed their mind and their behavior that radically. The army says that they could have dispersed and killed a lot of people in the Liberation Square, and that is certainly untrue because the army cannot kill 18 million people, and those are the people who demonstrated around the country.
Thank you. Bob, would you like to comment on the question?
Yeah, just a couple of quick answers. One, in terms of the question about are there international models for dealing with the intelligence services? Yes, there are, and in fact, the Germans had a delegation in Cairo early on that you may have read about. The Germans have extensive experience in terms of their
of their history with taking down the Stasi, the East German secret police, and they have come up with a very involved way of dealing with this. My understanding is what they have done is they have placed the totality of the files of the former secret police off limits, but they have allowed individuals to come in and read their own files. And so it's a sort of mix of public and of personal but not public disclosure. In terms of sectarian violence, you know, the U.S. has had a rather bitter recent experience with sectarian violence in Iraq. And so my understanding of U.S. policy in this area is that, on the one hand, we are very much against sectarian violence in any form. We are also very much in favor of the protection of rights of minorities. This is a situation where, as in other cases, certain members of Congress do take the treatment of Christians abroad very seriously. It would seem to me that, you know, if you have a new institution that's interested in dialogue, this may be an opportunity for dialogue, both in Egypt but also here in the United States on the Hill. It might be time for you to talk to staff.
Are they going to hear the other side? Because they are listening only from the Christian side. Are they going to listen to the other side? When you hear somebody, that's all I
know. Yeah, well, then they need to hear from you. And so hopefully they'll listen.
This lady right here. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Gulbranson from Freedom House. I have a question for all of the speakers, but from their individual perspectives. My question has to go to the specific issue of torture. And unfortunately, as we have seen, as countries transition from authoritarian systems to more democratic, it doesn't necessarily mean the abolishment of torture, but rather the transition from dirty torture to clean torture, or that which doesn't leave the lasting marks. And those marks, obviously, are required for documentation for the follow-up or the response that many of you talked about in terms of accountability in the courts. So my question is, what are some specific practical ideas that are either being discussed in Egypt or maybe have been discussed elsewhere around the world in terms of preventing torture at a systematic level, not just at the individual level? Because, again, as we know, the people implementing torture are often at the bottom of the ladder of hierarchy, and they're responding to orders that they receive. And then if they refuse, they're simply removed and somebody else is put in their place. So, again, I'm curious about what's being done to prevent torture at the systematic level.
Thank you.
Thank you. I might agree with some of the question mark raised by Omar about the role of the Egyptian army, but seeing what happened in Syria and Libya, it's fair to say that the Egyptian army have done very well so far. It may not have done the perfect job, but at least it's doing a good job so far. So that's fair analysis to say. Now back to the main subject. I really admire what Bob said and his perspective to the problem. I think that was an excellent perspective that I wish the Egyptian government consider. It's also fair to say that the problem is not only on the security force. I think that's the easy thing to consider, but we should admit that there is a problem with my fellow Egyptians themselves, the people.
May I ask if you have a question?
Yeah. What do you think, for my Egyptian fellows, what do you think we should do with extremists on both sides, especially on the Muslim side, what they call in the media the fundamentalist or the Salafist? Because there seem to be a big problem with them, and the government and to take any swift action against them.
Okay, we have a question in the back of the room.
My name is Sahar Aziz, and I'm with a group of about 30 Egyptian-American attorneys in the Egyptian-American Rule of Law Association. And we're working on providing technical legal assistance to the Egyptian legal community on some of these issues. And so I guess I have a conceptual question of, is it even worth the time? When you're trying to reform the system and you have these very complicated relationships and individuals who are part of the former regime, is it a useful, is it a good use of resources to focus on rule of law? And if so, how specifically, do you think it's worth the time to support civil society to serve as a watchdog by giving them specific legal tools such as freedom of information or sunshine laws so that they can then use those laws to find out what is the Army doing, what is the military, the intelligence service and the police doing? Or is the problem much more complicated than that and that law is essentially just going to look good on the books but it won't get any farther than that?
Okay, I'm going to take, if there are one or two more questions, I can take them. Okay, I see one behind the lady who just spoke.
Hi, I'm Julie Taylor from the RAND Corporation, and my question is, you've mentioned a whole laundry list of items, this is for the whole panel, that you think are necessary for real democratic consolidation and security sector reform. I'm still wondering how many of those are actually doable at this time, how many you think are actually necessary. So, for example, if you were not able to get civilian oversight of the military budget, but you were able to get more transparency on the economic role of the military, are these things that would be okay for right now and then you could transfer to more civilian control later?
Okay, and I think there was one more question. Okay, right there, please. And then we'll let each of the speakers have a last word responding to these.
Thank you. Amir Ahmadi from the National Endowment for Democracy. And my question has to do with restoring public confidence in the police in Egypt. Of course, larger reform will be a big part of that. But is there any space or willingness on the part of the security apparatus to engage directly with citizens? There was some reference to public monitoring groups and civil society. What role can citizens do at this point to communicate directly to the police forces? And also, is there a mechanism in place within the security apparatus that allows for direct citizen complaints and internal investigations that could be activated? And I imagine it wasn't activated in the past. But is that some form of immediate reform that could be activated at this point? Thanks.
Okay, thank you. And, you know, perhaps you saw, Amira, there was something, I think, in a Shuruq newspaper today about this. The Interior Ministry announced that it's partnering with state television to engage with the public and solicit feedback about the performance of the security apparatus. So there is something underway. Let's start with you, Bob. Would you like to answer these questions and make any concluding remarks you would briefly?
Yeah, very briefly. Okay, thanks very much. Maybe all of this comes together. The question about torture, the question about legal reform, and the question about parliamentary oversight. Absent legal reform and absent specific training for the police so that there is an option within the legal system and there is an option within the police to forced confessions, you're going to have continued torture practiced by the security forces because they have no alternative. And so one of the goals of police training in all of these situations, and we're still struggling with this mightily in Iraq, is to provide the police with a wherewithal to have some option to actually forcing a confession. And so that then runs to the issue of legal reform. Unless the laws really require this, unless there is a legal basis upon which to do this, and unless the judicial authorities are willing to accept evidentiary-based convictions rather than confessions, you know, you're not going to move away from torture, and that's a problem, again, in Iraq, where the courts have been very reluctant to accept evidence as a means for getting convictions if there is no confession on the part of the accused. And then finally, parliamentary oversight. You know, you don't get to these the kind of parliamentary oversight that we have in the United States Congress of the Department of Defense budget and weapons procurement and these other things without legal requirements this happen. And then the tradition follows. So I think all of these are interrelated and very important.
Thank you. Ahmad?
أنا عايز بس أضيف حاجة صغيرة إن 35% من قضاة مصر كانوا ضباط شرطة وضباط في أمن الدولة والبحث الجنائي فيعني دي للمعلومة واللي بيحكموا دلوقتي حبيب العدلي كان ضابط شرطة فدي معلومة صغيرة بنتكلم على التعذيب
I would like to mention that 35% of the judges in Egypt right now had been ex-police officers And the guy who is investigating with the ex-minister of Interior right now has been a police officer also, so I wanted that to be clear to everybody.
تعذيب كان من أهم أسباب قيام ثورة 25 يناير هو التعذيب، وخاصة أنا بعتبر أن الشهيد خالد سعيد هو مفجر ثورة 25 يناير لما تقتل على إيد الشرطة، وبالتالي سهل جدا بس لابد أن يكون في رقابة شعبية. هو ده سؤال مشترك بين الأستاذة أميرة وبين حضرتك، لابد يكون في رقابة شعبية من المجتمع زي ما بيحصل دلوقتي. مجلس العسكري ياخد قرار نطلع سوزان مبارك، الناس تطلع له يروح راجع في القرار يقولك حنوديها تاني، وبالتالي لابد من يكون، وده سهل جدا يتعمل، لجان شعبية في كل مركز أو محافظة مكون من عضو البرلمان، عضو المجلس المحلي، 4 من المحامين يتلقى الشكاوى ويكون ليه القدرة على الانتقال لمعاينة التعذيب أو الحجز بدون وجه حق. الرقابة الشعبية، لأن السلطة المطلقة مفسدة مطلقة.
Concerning torture, I would like to mention that torture was one of the very important reasons that caused the eruption of the January 25 revolution. And he mentions a very well-known for Egyptians, very well-known thing that a young man, 21 or 28 years old, I don't remember, who was hit to death. I mean, his head was hit against marble of an entrance of a building. And the guy's skull was really distorted, and that carried a huge emotional charge for all of us Egyptians who witnessed that. So he says that this was one of the examples of torture that caused the revolution. And now the solution is popular surveillance, popular supervision, and this is very important for the society, like what is happening right now. There is a kind of supervision by the public, public supervision to the some decisions of the military council. Like, for instance, the council has taken the decision to release Suzanne Mubarak, the wife of the president. And if there is public pressure by the people, then the council will withdraw the decision. And that happened several times before during the few months since January 25th. And he's suggesting that this supervision takes the form of committees, popular committees. The committee would consist, for instance, in one parliamentarian, one member of the local council in the village or the city or whatever, and 4 lawyers. And those guys forming this committee would receive complaints from people, complaints of torture, and they should have the authority to go into police centers and investigate whether there is torture or not, and if there is, they would investigate in place.
Please. About torture, I think this is part of security reform. Prisons should be under inspection, and the results of this inspection should be given to the people periodically. And I think this is missing in many Arab countries, and was also missing for certain time in Egypt. But the attitude, I think, that all these prisons will be under inspection to raise any torture taking place. I don't think this will happen. And if it happened now, it appear in the morning in many sites and also in many newspaper and so on. I mean, Egypt is now very open, and I cannot expect that anyone can risk now by applying torture on anybody. In the future, and please, in the past, this torture was a case and a story of many of Egyptian films, and it appeared, and it was a famous film. It was followed by the people, and I think cinema and theater and also all kinds of advertising is a tool against any case like that. And I think also now the civil society is doing a big role in this direction. Once they detect something like that, they release it, And also it became clear in front everybody is this is happening. Or at least it raised the case, and then the community can discuss it if it is true or not.
Okay, I think we've heard some different views about the nature of the security problems right now and what's actually going on, maybe more consensus about where it needs to go, but I think this will be an issue we'll be following for some time. I want to thank Mohammed Qadri Saeed, Omar Afifi, Mukhtar Kamel, and Robert Perito for joining me on this panel, and thank you for attending.